Hi, my name is Florian Hofmeister, and you are listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Greetings there, Ben Rock.
Howdy.
Howdy to you. Hey, it is another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast.
The Cinematography Podcast.
Cinematography.
Not the Cinematography Paid Podcast.
It costs you nothing on the Cinematography Podcast.
Yeah, no, I think we're starting a new thing here. I think we can, let's roll with this.
Yeah, I think so too. Hey, who's on the show today?
Very, very excited. It's Florian Hofmeister, who shot True Detective, Night Country, which I just think is an amazing show, an amazing looking show. It harkened back to a simpler time where you would have appointment TV before streaming just dumped everything on you all at once like an avalanche of bricks.
It was previously a short end for me. I really loved the season. I thought it was fantastic. And you're right, appointment television. I looked forward to it every week. And it doesn't disappoint.
It does not disappoint.
If you have not seen Night Country, geez, you got to start watching that. I know, you know, it's still sort of the era of peak TV. There's still a lot of stuff out there that people have never seen.
It was made in the era of peak TV. And Florian Hofmeister, he's a master of the craft. And we've had him on before. You've interviewed him before. And he's one of the best.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now, Close Focus.
So, Ben, a lot has happened in this past week. So our Close Focus, what do we have to talk about? Is it a roundup? Should we talk about a few things?
Yeah, we talked about doing at least two things, and I wanted to jump in and do the first one, which was sort of an in memoriam of Roger Corman. Roger Corman, who, without Roger Corman, who wouldn't we have as filmmakers? I'll start. I bet we can go back and forth at this. I'm going to start with, I'm going to big volley, Martin Scorsese. Now you say someone.
Yeah, Jim Cameron.
Ron Howard.
Francis Ford Coppola.
Peter Bogdanovich.
Jesus Christ, now you're getting deep.
I got two more on deck.
I'm sure you do. In the battle of people.
Joe Dante.
Jack Nicholson.
Jonathan Demme. Oh,
well done.
The truth is, Roger Corman was an independent filmmaker's independent filmmaker. Without him, there's no independent film world. He's responsible for stuff like Easy Rider because he made a bunch of biker movies with Peter Fonda. On and on and on. I actually met the man once. Did you ever meet him?
Never met him, no, but I worked there, and I worked for Concord New Horizons Studios, and a bunch of my friends from back in the day, they all worked there too. And the last job that I did there, the person who replaced me when I could not work for them anymore was Dave Klein was probably fresh off of, like, you know, Mallrats or something at that point. He'd done stuff for Kevin Smith, and I think that was really his entry into there. And then he did Corman for a while before his career totally took off.
Yeah, Corman, I met him because I had done projection design for a live theater show called SciFest that was like a science fiction one-act play festival. And they gave away an award every year, and they had Roger Corman giving them away one year. And they invited me to the thing, and Lee Costello, the producer of SciFest, was like, "Do you want to meet Roger Corman?" And I was like, "Yes." And she took me backstage, and he was very cool and gracious. You know, what do you say to the guy who broke everybody? What do you say to the guy who sort of made independent cinema as we all know and understand it today?
You know, I think it's really interesting because a lot of people associate independent cinema, at least a certain level of independent cinema. I mean, he wrote a book, if I recall, called like How I Made 100 Pictures and Never Lost a Dime. I mean, he made a bunch of generally lower budget, generally schlocky movies, maybe not all of them, but that was the consensus for a lot of
people. There was a model.
There was. I feel like in some ways it was counter-programming. It was counter-programming to the more slick and glossy, you know, sort of Hollywood aesthetic that people were accustomed to getting. And in some ways it was a precursor to like the YouTubification and indie cinema of the 80s and 90s and sort of the DIY, more punk aesthetic of sort of like, you know, the El Mariachis and other people who kind of came up throughout, you know,
1,000,000%.
Yeah. So he in some ways is the prototype, but it's interesting because even though there's been some other companies that have tried it, and I'm thinking of like PM Entertainment and some other sort of people out there, the Asylum. The Asylum is exactly the same. They are the most contemporary example, I would say, of a Roger Corman style studio now is the Asylum. But even they are, you know, by Roger Corman standards, their production value is so high now. It's really incredible. So I think
Corman
that,
standards, but here's what I'll say about Roger Corman versus everyone else who ever tried to do what Roger Corman did. Roger Corman would find very ambitious, talented filmmakers like a young Joe Dante or whatever. And he would give them the opportunity to run with it.
To make as good of a film as they could.
And he would encourage them to make it good. And having worked for Ron Howard once, he kind of told us the Roger Corman story, which was basically that when he did his first movie for them, was it Grand Theft Auto?
Might have been. Yeah, it might have been.
I believe that was his first movie as director. And he did it for Corman. And Corman said, if you do this well, you'll never have to work for me again. and that was kind of the motto. And I feel like knowing people who've worked for some of these other companies, that it's almost the opposite, where the company kind of has a vibe and a look that they're going for and I'm just going to say a cheapness that they're not willing to compromise with. They're not willing to let the filmmakers take a chance and do something interesting. And, you know, go watch Dementia 13 or Boxcar Bertha. Hey, I forgot about Woody Allen. Woody Allen's first movie as director was What's Up, Tiger Lily, which was made for Corman.
Wow, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Completely.
I mean, it's like a whole generation of filmmakers who then kind of went on to conquer Hollywood, started out with this guy who encouraged them to do their best with almost nothing. And I feel like on this show, we've chronicled so many of those DPs who started out trying to make a splash with very little. You know, it feels like we've talked to a lot of people who started on Red Shoe Diaries, a lot of people who started in music videos and commercials, and a lot of people who started for Corman.
And sometimes all three.
and there isn't anything like that, I don't think, today. And it's, you know, maybe just because of the place movies have in our culture today. But Roger Corman was one of a kind and leaves a legacy of over 400 movies as producer. 400 movies.
I think the reason that Roger Corman was successful, though, is he had his distribution figured out up front. Before he ever, like most people who I would say who go out to make movies, they don't necessarily have the whole monetization process figured out. But he had theatrical. He had home video. He had all kinds of, he had drive-ins. He had his.
But like, before there was home video. I mean, if you think about like in the 1960s when he did all those Edgar Allan Poe adaptations with Vincent Price.
B-movies. Oh, yeah. He had, you know, the double feature weekend matinee B-movies sewn up. He had.
And how many movies that were the A picture to the Vincent Price Fall of the House of Usher kind of movies are just like lost to time, but we're still watching the Roger Corman produced low budget Edgar Allan Poe adaptations.
You know, I mean, there's something to be said that you can draw a direct line from Roger Corman to Tommy Wiseau. I mean, really, it's like, you know, I think it looked like I bit into a lemon.
It did look exactly like that.
I mean, I'm telling you, when you're talking about the independent DIY, traditional sort of entertainment.
I would rather draw the line from Roger Corman to Darren Aronofsky or to Richard Linklater or to.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I think so much of Corman's movies, though, were like, it was entertainment, but was it high art entertainment or was it a platform for launching new talent?
Tommy Wiseau was neither of those things. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, but it was schlock, and there's an element of schlock.
Yeah. So. Oh God.
All right.
To the afterlife. I apologize, Roger Corman, that Tommy Wiseau was mentioned in the same sentence as your name. Anyway.
Wow. Okay. Well, look. No disrespect to the man. He has tremendous accomplishments, but you know, he was the original Troma. He was the original person playing in a market that other people weren't playing in, and he dominated it. He really did.
Troma wishes that they were Roger Corman. And I say that with all due respect.
Okay. All right. So Ben, yeah, what else do we have to talk about?
So the other close focus that wanted to talk about is that some details have emerged about Nikon's acquisition of Red.
That's right.
I found shocking, and I heard them from you. So I'm going to let you roll with it.
All right. It's been widely reported that Nikon paid $85 million to acquire Red.
What the fuck?
A lot of people I talked to, I think they thought that Red was much bigger, much more valuable.
I assume.
A lot more. Yeah. They were, you know, arguably the number two cinema camera maker out there behind Arri for a long time. You know, Sony definitely makes more cameras and more strata of the market.
I'm an idiot. But like, if you were to buy, say, Sony's camera line, mm-hmm. Is it comparable in price? That division of Sony. Could you get it?
No, No, of course not. Sony is a massive international conglomerate.
Well, not all of Sony, but if you were to buy just the camera, just the professional camera slice of Sony.
I don't think you could. They have their own fabs. You know, Red doesn't have a fab. They have to rent time in other people's fabs to make their sensors. You know, mm-hmm. Red has to do a lot of things out of house. Sony is one of the few companies that can do a lot of stuff in-house, which is incredible. So, no, they've got billions of dollars of infrastructure inside of Sony. So... The short answer is no, you couldn't do that. But they were competing in the same space. They were competing for the same customers. They were competing for the same rental houses, the same, you know, television networks.
I'm not saying that I had $85 million lying around, but $85 million just seems like a doable sum of money to buy a giant sector of a business like that Red basically occupied.
I had heard about other companies, and I won't name them, but I heard about other companies looking at Red and deciding not to buy them over the last few years. So that's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting to me that
in a world where Twitter is worth $42 billion, it's hard for me to believe that Red is worth $85 million. Maybe I've been inured to just like obscenely large numbers for theoretical things like, you know, that are tech.
Well, I'm told it doesn't include Red Studios Hollywood, which I'm sure the real estate of that is probably worth at least half of, you know, what Red sold for.
What's going to happen with that? That used to be Renmar Studios. I had an office there once.
Yeah, the current Red, former Renmar, to my knowledge, continues to be owned by, you know, one of Jim Gennard's companies or whatnot. So I have a feeling that it's probably not the same company that the Red Camera Digital Cinema company was out of Nevada. So yeah, that's probably was just not on the table. But I'm wondering, maybe they could have bought it if they wanted to, but I don't think that Nikon needed to own a studio. So that's probably not necessarily something that they really had to have. But I don't know, it's certainly interesting. That number seems to have definitely kind of made its way around the internet, certainly in certain circles, a lot, with most people having a reaction similar to yours, which was, oh, they thought Red was going to go for a lot more. But when a public company buys you, that information is all public. Everyone's going to know what it is. And so we're all learning about it now.
I guess the more I think about it, the more I just feel like we're awash with so many things going for inordinately high sums of money, and everything sounds like it should cost $1 billion. Like, didn't Frame.io get sold to Adobe for, you know, it was like $1.5 billion or something? So you assume that the machine that creates the movies would go for more, but
Yeah, hardware is not valued quite as much as like other reasons, other assets and other things these days. So yeah, I don't know. I think if someone was very enterprising and they really wanted to own Hollywood, they could come in and they could buy a huge swath of the industry. I actually wouldn't be surprised if Nikon decided to do that. If Nikon decided to come in and said, hey, we're going to pluck you, rental house, and we're going to own you. We're going to pluck you, other company, and we're going to come in and create all this infrastructure and create all this stuff. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me that they're of a size that they raise their valuation by who they own and what they do with it. So yeah, there's not a lot of people talking very much about what the immediate future is for Red/Nikon. But like I said before, I'm very bullish on the whole thing. I actually think it's going to be quite interesting, and I think they're going to do some pretty good stuff. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
We're all going to be pulling our focus backwards before we know it.
And your reference to the direction in which Nikon lenses adjust their focus just made about a dozen people out there smile. So well done.
You're welcome, everyone.
Yeah.
let's get to the interview with Florian Hofmeister.
Let's do it.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
So first of all, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I have to tell you that Night Country was appointment viewing at my house, and my only complaint and my wife's only complaint was that it was only 6 episodes. We ate that show up, and it was just some amazing and brilliant work. So thanks for coming on the show, and thanks for shooting True Detective Night Country. It was just an amazing piece of work.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. You've done some amazing work over the years. Let's just start with the beginning with Night Country. What brought you to the project? Like the director, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, Isa Lopez, she had done a film that I've been telling people about for years called Tigers Are Not Afraid. That's like one of the best Guillermo del Toro-esque horror-ish movies in years. Like I love that movie. How did she find you? Where was the meeting of the minds between you and Isa on the show?
Yeah, it's a good question. I unfortunately never know how they find me, because I only like that they find me, because they're basically the phone rings, you know. Yeah. And then, so we didn't have a relationship prior to this, if you know, that would answer the question a bit. So it was just a regular contact they made, and I thought that the scripts were, you know, they were very well crafted. You could already see that there would be a kind of a draw. First, it starts at who's done it, and then it goes into what is all of this about, actually. And then, you know, you kind of venture away in other elements of her stories, you know, the supernatural, and also just this feeling of fragmentation. You know, people are fragmented, they can't get to each other, they're separated from nature. All a very, very rich stew she had cooked up. So there was lots to talk about in terms of the scripts, and I think we really enjoyed that conversation. And then sometimes I do is after the fact, after the conversation, I might send over some images. Sometimes people, I think, bring images to the interview. You know, I don't really want to do that, because I feel that the first contact should be really open, because I'm interested in what she has to say, how I respond to it, you know. And so I sent her some images afterwards, just as a form to maybe visualize some of the ideas we had talked about. There's a photographer that I really cherished called Alexander Gronsky, who I kind of discovered a little later in the process. He's a Russian photographer who did an amazing piece about people in the at the Arctic Circle in Russia working in mines. And that was beautiful photography. So I used some of that. I used some iconic moments that I, for example, found. A film that I really cherish is Sicario.
Oh, yeah.
Because Sicario is an interesting film, because I think there's and there was the parallel that we talked about, is it still has a procedural story element. You know, people go to solve a case. So you have meetings, you sit there and people say, oh, he did this and she did that, and can we see the files? And obviously Sicario detaches completely from that. So they are almost sitting back to the furthest they can whenever it gets procedural. And I thought there should be something similar to True Detective, that the procedure is like part of the brand and it's part of the show, but it should not affect the cinematography. It's almost as if we are basically, we happen to be in the room and we observe it, but the cinematography should never be motivated in terms of solving it. I think that cinematography should have a different task than the procedural. And I think Sicario is a fantastic film, you know, that exemplifies this on a masterly level. There's also some other stuff in Sicario where I remember there's a beautiful scene, quite a harsh scene, where the Emily Blunt character gets picked up at the bar, and then it turns out that the guy is one of the baddies and he's trying to actually kill her. There are some elements where you're in a very domestic setting, but the Roger Deakins, you know, who is, of course, the hero of all of us.
Of course, yeah.
he pushes the depiction of people in the wider shots almost into silhouettes, even though it's a small domestic space. You know, and there was a reference which I thought was interesting, because, you know, you have the procedural in True Detective, but you also have the domestic when you follow all these characters into their own personal lives. And I think it's a virtue that I try to live up to, you know, to try to get an iconic cinematic moment out of a very mundane, utilitarian domestic situation.
Well, let me ask you too, because you brought up the idea of not being a procedural. If you were shooting it as a procedural, like, what would you say would be the hallmarks of that genre if it was a procedural? Because obviously, when I first heard of this, I was like, Jodie Foster, Silence of the Lambs, I could watch her talk about star-shaped, you know, entry wounds all day long. And Silence of the Lambs, possibly the movie I've seen the most in my life, is also a procedural that's not a procedural.
Yeah, I think it has to do with, you know, also the, I think it's more like an internal attitude towards that. So, I mean, if you watch a proper cop drama, you know, one of those.
Yeah, CSI or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they will obviously go and they will cover every point that's made in closer coverage. So I think the editorial rhythm is absolutely motivated by what facts do we have to catch to understand or to build a bigger mystery or to create a bigger mystery. But I think it's very much broken too into closer coverage, that every point that's being made in the dialogue is also accentuated in the cinematography. And I think that in more cinematic ways to approach scenes like that, you wouldn't punctuate it all the time. You know, you might just choose a more deliberate angle that tells a different story, or you might choose to hang back, not go too close, because it's that's what I think Sicario does all the time. What we also try to do at times, just hanging back. The Silence of the Lambs is a fantastic example, because you really feel the film is about something completely different.
I mean, Silence of the Lambs is a goddamn perfect movie. So, there's almost nothing better, in my opinion.
I think we have to go back to it. It would be lovely to go back to it and watch it after, over this conversation, because I'm sure you could break it down more methodically. It's more a feeling that I have towards that than, actual the scientifically proven point. But I would say they will treat this procedural different.
Well, I think that there's something in common here, not to go too much on a Silence of the Lambs jag, but I feel like Silence of the Lambs, the reason it doesn't feel like you're watching a procedural cop drama is because it's really an unrequited romance. It's a romance between Clarice Starling and Hannibal Lecter that's unrequitable. And the more you have two characters who are obviously in love, who can't get close to each other, the more you want them to. And I feel like this is very, Night Country is very similar in that respect, in that you have all these characters who have secrets that they're keeping from each other, or secrets they're keeping with someone else, but they don't really trust that person. And it's, there's a crime. The crime is incomprehensible and, revealed in the first episode. But really, in order to get to the bottom of it, these people have to kind of deal with their own shit. And so that kind of plays into what you're saying, I think, which is that you're way more about the character stuff than about like giving me a leering close up of every little clue and constantly reminding me of the trail of clues we're following. You do that just enough so that I remember that there's a crime that I'm on.
And actually, just listening to you, it just brought back to my attention. It starts, as always, with the script, obviously.
Yeah.
Think the procedural, my reference or my thought process around the procedural is, because if you work in a serial context, we still have to shoot this as a miniseries.
Yeah.
So obviously we don't have that time, that you spend on a feature film. You have to move quickly at times or quicker.
And you're making six episodes too. That's a lot.
And it's just a reminder that you shouldn't fall into that trap. That you should make your choice and say, okay, I'm actually focusing more on the supernatural. I'm focusing on the mystery and I'm focusing on the darkness. The case will have to reveal itself. It doesn't make
sense. Yeah, no, that actually makes a lot of sense. And my takeaway based on what you're saying is really that you were more focused on just the characters and the relationships. And I mean, obviously you're following the script. So if the script describes them picking a tongue up off the floor, you're going to film the tongue being picked up off the floor. But
in all our conversations, Issa and myself, that was always what we would focus on, and then the rest kind of falls into place there.
How many of there's plenty of scenes that are just like out in the dark in the snow. How many of these are for real? Like, did you guys go out into snowy areas in the pitch blackness, or was it a set, or was it green screen, or how did you pull that stuff off?
So there's the scene when people are naked in the ice, or when people run away, barefoot. Those obviously we had to do on a stage, some of it. And the rest is all shot outside. But there's also one scene where somebody dances in the snow.
Yeah.
And she did it barefoot outside as well.
And that was, I think, in the first or second episode, right? That was pretty early.
I think it's in the first.
Yeah, yeah.
So, we did a mixture of...
how cold was it, though? That's just... Man, the cold... I'm from Florida. Cold cuts right through me.
Iceland has a particular climate because, they sit right at the Gulf Stream. And normally a city like Reykjavik, they go like -5, -6 degrees Celsius. So they don't go that cold.
Oh.
And then it's up north where it gets cold. But the year we were there, it was the coldest winter they had had in 100 years.
Oh, Jesus.
We had minus 17 Celsius, but I don't know. For Alaska, that's probably normal. It was
in Alaska, they're wearing shorts. They're doing pickup basketball games in minus 17. Yeah.
It's people have always asked me, you know, how is it to shoot in the cold? And I always find it exhilarating to shoot in whatever climate. Very early in my career, I had shot something in the desert. And then for a little while, you become like the desert guy. And I shot desert. And that's, you know, it was really, really hot. But that's it's always very exhilarating to expose yourself and the technology to extreme circumstances.
Well, that would be my fear, too, is that, like, can the camera handle that cold? Is the camera going to just shut down?
Nothing shut down, ever.
Really?
It got so cold. The only thing that struggled was the monitoring. And when we hit, like, minus 17, the imagery wouldn't run smoothly anymore. You would have little trails or little lagging in it. But just the monitoring. No camera ever left us. And the rest is good clothing, you know. I mean, we started shooting in, I think, October. So the idea was we spend all the time till Christmas on a stage. And then after Christmas, when the real strong winter and the snow hit, then we went outside. And then at the end, come March, we went back onto the stages when the snow was melting. So those first weeks you had, you know, the first 6 weeks where we were only on stages, the one topic that everybody talks about from the Icelandic crew is the clothing that we all have to get prepared, you know. Mm-hmm. And everybody has an opinion about shoes and he has three pairs of them. And so it's just about clothing. And, you know, Iceland is a place where you can get good winter clothing. So
I would hope so. Just wear part of Bjork's wardrobe and you're covered, you know, just you have to wear the weird hat. Sorry. Had to make a Bjork reference. And so you're shooting during the night months too. So it's like, is it light at all? Like what, how much sunlight do you even get? And how weird is that for you? I mean, like I know just night shoots in general can be a bit of a slog, you know, cause you just feel like a vampire, but what's it like when it's just, you're just that all day long?
Yeah. It is a little bit like in the series. So, I mean, the one thing, the sun actually comes up in Iceland a little bit because we are still not beyond the Arctic Circle, you know.
Yeah.
So it'll say, so you would wake up, say you wake up at 7 o'clock or something by like, or say you wake up on a Sunday at 10 o'clock. So you've slept in a bit. You would wake up and it would look and feel like it's like 5 o'clock at night. It's like pitch black. And then it would stay pitch black till probably 12:30. And then it starts to dawn. And then at like 2, the sun might come up for, you know, literally for 20 minutes. And it will not come up high above the horizon, maybe like the width of your thumb, you know, when you look at it. It just comes about up and then it disappears. And then you have about an hour and a half to 2 hours of a beautiful blue hour. And then it gets dark again at whatever, 4 o'clock. So you have maybe 4 hours of 2 hours of a sunrise, 5 minutes of sun, and then 2 hours of a sunset. So the lighting is spectacular. The light is just beautiful. It's just very, you know, just imagine you would walk around in sunrise and sunset for 4 hours.
No, that does actually sound pretty awesome. But how does that affect your shooting choices, though? How does that affect your scheduling?
Well, we could never really, you know, shoot in those. I mean, we had a few scenes where we shot in those lighting conditions. Yeah. A couple of times, you know, when they travel in their car, they were just on the verge of, it was either just sunrise or just complete darkness. So we used those and the rest of the time we only shot after it gotten dark. So the actual working hours, you don't go that late. So say on a regular day, we would probably start like say at 2. Then you would have an hour to prep before it got really dark, you know, hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And then you shoot till, you know, we shot 10 hours continuous. So you end up at 12 o'clock, you know, you go back home.
Oh, so it's almost like shooting splits.
Yes, exactly. It felt more like splits. But what one has to mention is after a while, if the darkness is quite something. So you actually, I... I did find myself switching on every single light in my apartment on my day off.
Yeah, that's I'm wondering, like, is it something interesting or something maddening? Like, I my brain goes to the movie Insomnia, actually the Christopher Nolan version of Insomnia, where Al Pacino's going crazy because it's never dark, and, you know, and it's the opposite of that, where it's like almost constantly dark.
No, it didn't really affect me psychologically, but it you just tend to. You just notice that you start behaving differently. And also you would try, you know, on your day off, you would try to make sure that you go outside in those 4 hours, you know, and you take a walk and you just see some stuff. And, you know, I mean, the good thing about Iceland is it's geothermal, which is fascinating. They generate all their electricity through geothermal activity.
Really?
So, yeah, they are absolutely, they have zero footprint. So people will literally leave on their lights all night if they have to. It's the cost of electricity is astonishingly small in that country. You know, that's a fascinating fact.
Now, let's talk a little bit about lenses. And again, you know, it's like such a special, specific case study. I guess every movie, every show has its own challenges. But because this is like almost entirely taking place in this endless night world, did that affect the lens choices that you had, or the f-stops you tended to shoot at, or the focal lengths that you used? Talk about your choices around that stuff.
Well, because my approach to say the highlights was utilitarian, and I wanted to have highlights and I wanted to use strong highlights, I wasn't that much worried about exposure. I knew that I would have certain stuff around that would create a solid exposure in the mids and the highlights, and I wanted to let the blacks just drop off. So I wasn't so keen on a very fast lens for practical reasons. In that year, Arri brought out the Alexa 35.
Yeah.
And obviously that camera has a very big dynamic range, especially in the highlights, which I was interested in. Because if you say you want to have the highlights scream like an electric guitar, you don't want to distort it. You know, you want to... Yeah. Feel color even in the highest highlights. So I was very interested in the camera. So they were still rolling it out slowly, but I got a hold of one, and I was in London and I went to Panavision and I just took a small variety of glass and I quickly put it on. But I came across these old Panavision primes, they call the Ultra and the Super Speeds, but they had a very lovely soft but also focused and feel. So they weren't too sharp, but they were sharp enough. And they live around a 2 to a 2.8. And I normally always end up at a 2.5, no matter what I do. I've shot 2.5 since my first day at film school somehow. You know? And then, you know, the good thing about the Alexa is you can also easily oomph up the ASA. So I knew that when we were to run into trouble, you could go up, you know. And I rated the camera at 1280 and we shot with those Panavision lenses.
So when the show first premiered, and I this again might be more of a production design question, but when the show first premiered, I kept seeing all these think pieces that were saying how self-aware the show was of some of the references, some comps, shall we say, specifically like John Carpenter's The Thing. Like early on, there's a shot where we see a VHS tape of John Carpenter's The Thing sitting on a shelf. How much of that were you and Issa thinking about when you were shooting it? I also was brought to mind, there was a show from, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago from the BBC called Fortitude that also takes place in the Arctic Circle, and it's also kind of a supernatural and procedural show. Like, it's a really good show. But I was wondering if there were any, I don't want to say Easter eggs, but any like self-awareness of like, yeah, I know someone's going to bring up John Carpenter's The Thing when we talk about this scene or whatever.
So John Carpenter, The Thing was actually a film that I watched beforehand. It's an absolute masterpiece. I watched it when I was a young film student. I hadn't seen it in years. And
possibly second only to The Silence of the Lambs, or maybe more than Silence of the Lambs. I've watched that movie dozens, maybe hundreds of times.
It's just, you know, and even watching it back this time, I became so aware of the metaphoric quality of it. Yeah. I mean, watch it now, you don't even think about it as being a horror film anymore. You think it's actually a big metaphor about, you know, mankind and compartmentalization and what happens psychologically if people assign themselves to certain ideas. So But what I liked visually about the film is it has, of course, elegance, like all these films from that time often have. But it also had a certain roughness. And I remember the very first shot of it, if I remember it correctly, is this wide shot. You could just see the wide landscape, and then suddenly it just shakes a bit, and then the helicopter comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you realize, oh, this might be a POV, and then this big chase starts. So to be not perfect, to let things, you know, fall away, or to be a bit edgy, to be a bit aggressive in the framing, that is what I took from that film and why I referenced it. And Isa, of course, cherishes it as well. So that was not a reference we discussed every day, but something that was definitely in my heart, and it's something that is in her heart as well. Now, in regards to all the Easter eggs, I have to say, when I shot this, I was not aware of the appeal that the brand True Detective still has. I was simply not aware. I mean, I was aware of it. I was aware of its achievements. I was aware of the discussions that people have had back in the day about, is season two and not a better, you know, worse, you know, all this stuff.
I just remember when season one went on, and it went down a Lovecraft hole, but also the Yellow King. Everyone was constantly talking about the King in Yellow, which was something that was referenced in the first season. And I feel like that's part of the brand True Detective, is it makes you want to like dig in and
exactly.
find more stuff.
So I wasn't aware of the brand, and I've become aware, obviously, since it's come out. It's a cultural icon that has become a real part of pop culture. And it's almost disconnected itself from, you know, its creators, and it's become this monolith. So I think that's something interesting, that a piece of television can actually reach that kind of status. It's an acknowledgement of the iconic life that this show has taken on. And it's like playing with elements. And I think that was very much her reference also in the scripts. I remember when we shot this very first scene in the Arctic station, I actually didn't realize that she had put a DVD there of until we finished the shot. And I went up to her, I said, Isa, did you see that? There's the thing. Yeah. So it was playful. It was never something that, you know, we spend a lot of time on thinking about. The one thing I can say, though, is, you know, because I absolutely loved Silence of the Lambs, and I also loved Taxi Driver, and I had seen Jodie Foster in many films that have really shaped my idea of American cinema, and of, you know, in particular, and in cinema in general. And she's the nicest person, you know, she's absolutely hands-on, and she's a true soldier of cinema. But there's moments when she pops up in the frame in the close up, and you go, God.
I know. I would freak out.
Even me being there, it still had the effect on me, you know.
Because she's so iconic. Film. And also, like, she hasn't been doing that much for a while. Like, we haven't seen her on. Yeah. She hasn't been. And then, like, this year we had this and Naiad, you know, which she was also amazing in, you know, Oscar nominated performance. It's one of the, there's a lot of people like that who are just like such a treasure, and you almost take them for granted. But, and also you don't want to see them like wear out the same deal, but she's so different in this than anything I've ever seen her in.
No, and so I had exactly those moments live on set. And I was looking at the monitor. Well, I mean, then you get used to it a little bit, you know, after a while. But and the chemistry between both of them, you know, Kaylee Rice, you know, that's another story, because she, you know, her acting background is quite fresh. You know, she's a fighter. And to see them both together was just really beautiful. And Kaylee is a force of nature. So it was cold. But there was a lot of people with warm hearts around me, and it was a privilege to be working with all these women.
Okay, well, I think that's a wonderful place to leave it. Before we go, is there a place online where you'd like people to check out your work? Website, Instagram, TikTok? What do you do?
No, I don't. Elizabeth, I try to get out of all of this, man. Try to get away from the screens. Go into the cinema and write me a letter, please. I do have a website, of course, but they're badly kept. I think we should all go into the cinema with friends again.
I've been trying. I have been. I've been going.
Yeah, go do it, man.
Yeah.
Do it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And hopefully we can have you back when you've got your next project going, or any old time to just kind of talk about your whole career, because it'd be great to do like the full career. You've got so many things that you've done.
Thank you very much, man. It's been a pleasure to be here.
All right. So that was Florian Hofmeister. Florian, great having you back on the show again.
And everyone, definitely go watch True Detective Night Country. It's just freaking cool.
For sure.
Yeah.
And now, short ends.
So, Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's the time we talk about our pet obsessions. It's our, you know, moment where we get to, you know, pull back the curtain and let people know a little bit more about us and what we're into. So what are you into this week?
Well, I go down these rabbit holes on YouTube that I talk about a lot, and one of them came up really interesting. So a lot of them are editors talking about editing tricks and tips and stuff like that. And I found a channel called Finzar, and it's this British dude, I think he's British, who the title of the video was, "I tested the world's most expensive editing software." And I was like, what could that mean? Like, what does that mean? And can you guess what the world's most expensive editing software is? Software.
Not hard. Software. Okay.
I'll give you a hint. It's not Avid. It's obviously not Premiere. It's not Resolve.
Is it Lightworks?
You're getting close, but no.
Is it an outdated system?
It's not an outdated system. It's just a system. I don't freaking know anyone who uses it. It's Flame.
Flame. Gotcha.
So
yeah.
I remember going to NAB. I think it was the last time I went to NAB. It was probably like 2011 or 2012. And that was right after the fall of Final Cut Pro, when Apple had phased out Final Cut Pro 7 and brought in Final Cut Pro X, and no one liked it. And so Adobe and Resolve and everybody was kind of scrambling to get in there. And Flame was one of the ones. So Flame is like high-end compositing software, hardware and software made by Autodesk, like solid freaking thing. And they added an LE to it. And I remember downloading the free version of it, and I was like, this is like Final Cut Pro version 2. What the hell am I even looking at? And it was the weirdest combo of kind of a clunky NLE that didn't do anything in an intuitive way. You know, most, like, I don't love Avid, but honestly, Avid, Adobe Premiere, and DaVinci Resolve all do everything basically the same. And then Final Cut Pro 10 kind of has its own weird way of thinking. But again, like, it's not out of the box weird. Flame is super weird. And you can get the job done, but take a wild guess at how much you're looking at if you can't buy Flame, by the way. You license it.
Oh, okay. So it's like a monthly or annual subscription?
Yeah. How much would you pay annually for a piece of editing software? Again, when you consider that you have all of these, you know, Avid being probably the most expensive of that group, but you have all of these kind of floating around.
Jeez, I don't know. Is it like $8,000?
$4,870 per year.
Yeah, gotcha. So in 2 years, you've spent more than $8,000 on it.
Yeah. Now, the thing about Flame is that you can do outrageously high-end compositing on it. But the funny thing is, you know where else you can do high-end compositing? Basically every other piece of software that I just named. And
yeah,
Adobe,
and in DaVinci it's free.
Adobe has After Effects. And I mean, like, if you really want the premium version of DaVinci, it's, I think, $300.
$300, a single purchase, a one-time purchase. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not licensing it. It's not, I mean, like, you know, I do hear people complaining about Adobe. I do believe Adobe gives you value for that money. But like, if it was in the $4,000 per year range, there's no way. I don't understand how this can still work. And in this video, by the way, this guy decided, he's an editor, he decided to do a simple video that involved like some green screening, which should be an obvious and easy thing to do in Flame because that's what it's designed to do. And he eventually gives up. Spoiler alert, he gives up, and then he edits the thing in Premiere. Because he, like, after going to forums, you know, web forums and tutorial sites and all this stuff, he just can't wrap his head around Flame. And I sometimes wonder, I mean, like, there's always this weird legacy situation in our business where, like, someone who learned how to use a Flame in 1995 and either worked for a company or their company themselves, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on a single seat of this, has just stuck with it all this time. But that can't be a growth business for anybody. Like, that can't be how Autodesk is making their money.
I think it's really fun when you find an old website that at the bottom says this site has been optimized for Netscape version 22.6 or Microsoft Internet Explorer 4.0 or one of these things that's like is so outdated.
Mosaic.
Yes, exactly. So a Mosaic, which was the original, had 100% of the market in the early days, basically.
Yeah,
so,
in like 1994. Anyway, it's just funny to me because like Autodesk is still around. They're still one of the leaders in the business. But it was interesting to look at this because they're, even though I'd kind of forgotten that they were kind of an also ran for the second most used piece of editing software, the first being Avid, that they kind of lost out on that. But it was like I had stopped thinking about them. And I think this video is very interesting because it very clearly illustrates the very familiar feeling of banging your head against a wall when you're trying to learn a new piece of software, even though you have the skills, like you bring the skills of an editor or whatever it is to the software. But the software is just an opaque piece of shit that you can't figure your way through. And it's an interesting video to watch. Anyway, that is my short end.
I thought it was very fascinating. I'm interested. I'm curious.
So what is your pet obsession this week?
I just binged all the available episodes of Hacks season 3. So
I haven't seen it yet.
I won't spoil it. Adam Bricker's been on the show before. We talked about Hacks, and Adam's now in the ASC. I'm very excited for him. We'll have to have him come back and talk about Hacks season 3. If you like seasons 1 or 2, guess what? Buckle up. You are in for more of the same. It feels very much like a continuation. Not much time has passed, and we're right back into it. All the same characters are there, you know, all the same sort of like writing is there. It feels feels like a, you know, an old pair of shoes. You're putting it back on. It feels or slippers. It's comfortable.
Not even that
it's
old.
Like it's I know it's like, only the third season.
The show's only been out for 3 years.
I look forward to the next episode now, hanging out on the couch and watching it. It is like, it's feel good, fun television. And I know you have an aversion sometimes to shows that are more industry and insider.
I'm a fan of Hacks. I love Hacks.
It is so fun. It is so funny. Gene Smart is just also incredible. I love the whole thing. So there's something wonderful about the generational war and the comedy sort of insidery and battles of, you know, sensibilities between what's old and new and television and stand up. And, you know, I love it. It's great. It's my pet obsession this week. So Hacks season 3, if you haven't watched Hacks, get on it, try it. If you like it, you'll like this. If you don't like it, then stay far, far away, because it's exactly like the other seasons.
And before we go, let's each recommend a Roger Corman movie people could watch.
Little Shop of Horrors. There you go. Little Shop of Horrors. My recommendation.
Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, God, I saw it in the theater.
Such a good movie. I love that movie. It's so fun.
Yeah, I saw it on television, and I saw the special effects for Battle Beyond the Stars cut up and put into like two other things. And then I remember when I worked in a video store, we essentially had Battle Beyond the Stars, but it was like from another country. And it was just exactly the same movie, but like had a different title slapped on it. So
nice. I love that movie.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Incredible.
All right. So who do we need to thank this week as opposed to all the other weeks? You know, Ben Katz could literally just copy paste from last week.
Yeah, he could. Yeah, he doesn't actually need us to say these words, but you know, for those who are listening and like the thanking. So why don't we start off by thanking Ben Katz? Ben Katz is the reason we don't sound like complete slobbering idiots, which, boy, if he leaves that in, I'll sound like that slobbering idiot right now. So anyway, Ben Katz,
I'm covered with slobber right now. Yeah, and he's got it. Since we went to video, he has to like go into Mocha and track the drool off of my face.
So Ben Katz, editor, slicer, dicer, extraordinaire. We got to thank Kays Alatrachi, Kays, who made the music for our podcast, who's made all the music for the podcast you've heard today. And most, if not all of all the other podcasts. See, there's a few other pieces in there that might not be him, but 99% of it is Kays Alatrachi. So, and we got to thank Alana Cody, who is our producer, who basically sat us down and gave us homework for probably the next 3 weeks. So we got a bunch of stuff. We got to watch because there's a whole bunch of people want to come on the show, and we got to talk about it. So we got to watch some stuff so we know what we're talking about. That's kind of how it
what
goes.
What a drag having to watch like awesome TV and movies. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. It's woe is us. So it's so hard doing this job. So, yeah.
Anyway, well, right, Ilya, so you want to take us out?
No, where can people find you? Where can people find you?
Right here in this messy room that I'm in. You can find me at benrock.com. Go there and read up about me and watch my reel and find me on LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter. I've actually been watching TikTok videos. Not proud. I haven't posted one yet.
Yeah, I'm. You won't catch me.
You know, I could have made this my short end, but my friend Toby Wilkins has a really killer TikTok channel where he takes old cameras and mods them so you can put your iPhone into it and use them again.
Toby Wilkins is your friend?
Yeah, yeah.
Up here in Portland, Toby Wilkins.
He is in Portland, yeah.
You know, I just met him like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. He came by the shop in progress and we hung out and he showed me his thing. I didn't know you know him. That's such a small world.
I shot second unit for him once. Yeah, he's a great guy. Yeah.
Well, I'm borrowing his table saw right now. His table saw is on my floor.
Yeah. Toby's TikTok channel is pretty cool. I guess you've seen some of it now.
I've never seen his TikTok. I've only seen his Instagram. But
it's probably the same where he 3D prints these inserts to put into cameras so he could slide an iPhone in and use it.
He's told me that I sounded familiar, but clearly he didn't know from where. So clearly, if he ever talked to you or knows that you do a podcast with me, what a small world. I've known Toby
for like 15 years.
That's so random.
And wow. I've talked on the show a lot about doing second unit for the TV show Chosen for Crackle. He was the guy who brought me on. He was first unit director on that.
I know what I'm going to do later. I get to send Toby an Instagram message and blow his mind. This will be fun.
Yeah, yeah. He's
You know what? I'm just going to send him a link to this podcast. I'm going to send him a link to the podcast and say, hey, Toby, watch this. Like, I'm going to have to wait a day so this goes live. And then I'm going to like timestamp it. And it's like, Toby, you have to watch this. That'll be fun.
He's so talented. He's a great guy. Anyway.
All right. So, Ben, that's it for this episode. Do you want to take us out? You want to say, be kind, subscribe? What do you want to say? Thanks. You want to say, until next time? Come on.
I'll go with until next time.
Boom. It's done. You did it.
I hate being a cheese ball. Anyway, until next time.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.